Hello and welcome to the Right to Rumble podcast, screaming into your internet echo chamber one painful episode at a time. I'm Jimmy and I voted to leave the EU in 2016.
And I'm Jazza and I'm looking forward to Colin Firth possibly adopting me so that I too can become part of his extended British-Italian family.
So Colin Firth's Italian then?
He is Italian now. His wife is a movie producer or something and she's Italian. And his children, his two boys, are both Italian. Slash British, and now because of the whole Brexit thing and everything being a bit up in the air and a bit, oh God, what's going to happen? He's applied for Italian citizenship, and now Colin Firth, probably the most British person in existence ever, is now not completely British.
Is he the most British person in existence?
Think of somebody more British than
Stephen
him.
Fry, Hugh Laurie.
Oh, right, okay, fine.
Ed Miliband.
Ed Miliband?
Ed Miliband is too British. He needs to like cut that shit down a little bit.
Wasn't his father an enemy of the people?
He was like a Polish refugee, I think.
Yeah.
When I say Polish, Eastern European or something.
Jewish.
But yeah, Jewish is not, well, I guess, it's not a nationality, is it?
I mean,
he was Jewish as well, that's true. Mm-hmm. But Ed Miliband, I felt like he was too English, like,
really?
He was like excessively English.
What, more English than David Cameron?
Yeah. He was like Wallace and Gromit levels of English.
Oh, right, okay.
You know,
I understand what I'm saying?
As
soon as you like bring in the stop animation comedy, yeah, I understand what you're talking about.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he sort of like gestured at
having... He couldn't eat bacon sandwiches properly.
He couldn't.
Slightly incompetent.
He pretended to like the Boston Red Sox and have some affinity for America, but like...
Really?
Yeah, that was the thing.
How odd.
Because he lived in Boston with his dad or something when he was younger.
Oh, he's just from privileged... He represented Doncaster.
You're really upset about the fact he represented Doncaster.
Somebody who like grew up in like jetting around the world, the son of an academic, does not represent Doncaster. It does really annoy me.
Okay.
If we're going to have a representative democracy, have the people representing us actually represent us. Anyway, hello, welcome to the Righteous Honourable Podcast. We talk about current events, social issues... and politics every week.
Indeed. Some.
Also.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Some order of those three things, or maybe other things, depending on what Jess is feeling like at the time.
Yeah, no, it is all on my whim, let's be fair. What are we talking about this week, Jimmy?
We are talking, to start off with, about the fact that Uber has had its application for its license in London to be renewed, rejected.
Mm-hmm.
So
Transport for London.
Transport.
Been like, sorry guys, you don't report rape. Bye.
That's a simple summary.
It is a simple summary.
Simple and accurate. There's a bunch of other stuff, but basically, because Uber's run like a fucking shit show, they were like, we don't really want to offer you a license, to be honest.
Yeah, because we know how to run a multinational $1 billion.
I mean, I wouldn't do it, but I know like my limits.
You're not taking on more than you can handle.
Exactly. Well, I am, but even like the very minor stuff that I'm doing, I'm also not handling well. So, but then I'm not offering a transport service. So,
no.
You know,
this is fair. We're just doing a podcast on the internet.
Yes.
If we fuck this up, minimal people are affected in a bad way.
Well, you know, we might be misinforming our listeners. We probably are.
Yeah, I mean,
to some degree,
definitely happened.
Yeah, anyway, the people have gone crazy. Uber has appealed.
Who are the people?
Newspaper journalists who, like, you know, use Uber to get home when they're out on the lash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, feminists because, you know, it's endangering young women who can't walk home safely at night or whatever. Other stuff. Other people are outraged. Uber, I guess, are outraged because, you know, money.
Mm-hmm.
And people have also criticised Sadiq Khan for his role in this decision, even though he had no role in this decision because he doesn't sit on the board of TfL, which is the one that decides who gets the licences.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like in hock to the unions and, you know, smear. So, you know, whatever. It's a whole thing. So we'll be discussing that. Second up, what are we talking about?
So Catalonia, my home away from home.
You realise it's a Catalonia in English?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I never knew.
Yeah,
really?
It's like you're calling Germany Deutschland or something like that.
No, it's... Yeah, Catalonia.
Catalonia. Homage to Catalonia.
Cool, so Catalonia are planning on having what is turning into a bit of a shit show of an independence referendum on the 1st of October. So they had a symbolic referendum in 2014 that ended up having the Catalan president like, not, what's the word?
Removed from office?
But removed from office.
Yeah.
Because it was seen as illegal and just symbolic. So this time around, they're trying again. Good for them. But the Madrid central Spanish government have deemed it illegal because it's unconstitutional because it affects the rest of Spain or something like that. But what has happened, which is kind of worrying, is that the Guardia Civil, who are the police...
The federal police.
The federal police in Spain, have started going around and, like, possessing all of the ballot papers that were going to be used on the 1st of October.
So they've been moved into Catalonia and they're, like, tearing down referendum posters and, like, occupying offices and arresting officials and
all
of that stuff.
Literally, there are political prisoners now in Catalonia.
Woo!
And
they say Britain is badly governed.
I mean, it's really put the Scottish referendum in perspective. I'm like, well, that was great. And even Brexit, I'm like, well, at least we knew kind of what we were getting into. But there's a lot of kind of like identity politics surrounding the Catalan vote. And we're going to talk about that a little bit and the fact that Spain and democracy aren't getting on very well. And then finally, we're going to have an interview. Well, I'm going to have an interview with a German journalist about the German election.
Do you
I'll be
the,
fair, my mate, it's my mate Felix.
Okay.
So Angela Merkel has just won the German election for the fourth time running. She's doing very well. But this time she's only able to get a coalition that's just over 50% of the German parliament. And so.
And it will be a three-party coalition as well.
It will be a three-party coalition called a Jamaican coalition.
No, I assume that's based on like...
It's based on the party colours.
Colours, right. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an initials thing.
But also everybody's going to start eating jerk chicken in Germany.
Mm. Well, jerk chicken is tasty. That's one positive outcome, I guess.
Good for them.
The other side of the German elections is that Alternative for Deutschland, AfD...
Alternative for Deutschland.
They got, 12, 13% of the votes?
Something like that.
So they did really well.
They're getting about between 80 and 90 seats.
Yes. But they do have like some legit Nazis in there,
like genuine Nazis.
Yeah, not like
kind of with a splattering of really kind of articulate intellectual racists. So it's a lovely little alliance.
It's a broad coalition of racist people from dullards to smart people.
Yeah,
so that's cool.
Yeah, it's going really well. So we're gonna listen to some music. I'm gonna beg you for money, and then we'll get into this episode. Sound good?
Yeah, fine.
Great.
Yeah.
Excellent. Hello, dear listener. It's Jimmy and I on the other side of the music. Basically, we awkwardly, we've spent quite a lot of money putting this podcast together. If you wouldn't mind, if you think that this episode is worth a little bit of cash, a little bit of dollar, then maybe you'd think about being one of our patrons. You can pledge to give us like a dollar or two per episode, and it really helps us out.
And
we'll love you forever. We have a number of patrons already who are very kind, and I'm trying to find
he says out. Trying to find the list.
Trying to find the list. Where are you, list? Thank you to Dominique, Gemma, and Matt for being our patrons and supporting us and being so kind.
Three whole people. That's more than the people who run the podcast.
Yeah, more or less.
Got over that hurdle.
Jimmy, you also wanted to do some viewer engagement.
Viewer engagement. Viewer? Really?
Listener engagement.
Okay, fine. We sort of started doing this and then stopped, so I thought we would start again. So if you want to tweet us abuse, or maybe not, you know, nice stuff too, then we'll read it out. Probably. When are we next? Mate. Remember. So this is from, I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce your surname, I'm afraid. It's Mary Aikman.
Oh, yeah.
Is that you
Mary
said?
Aikman. Yeah, Aikman, yeah. I know Mary.
Yeah, well, you know.
Weird.
Presumably that's why she listens to the podcast.
Perhaps. But it's not anyway. Just people who know us, Jimmy. Come on.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I don't have 1,000 friends, so, or even people I know.
I probably do on Facebook. That's a bit depressing.
So it's all your friends then?
Yes.
Correct. Anyway, Mary, this is in relation to our discussion about Robert Webb's book, How Not to Be a Boy.
Yeah.
And she's tweeted, anytime J.D.E. Nichols brings up gender biology on Right Dishonor, and it is a picture of an anime girl smashing her head against the table repeatedly.
That's 100% how I feel.
Yeah.
As well, every single time.
There you go. So, I've acknowledged your tweet and I disagree with you.
You haven't been convinced by the GIF.
No, I haven't.
We also have a review on iTunes from THRJE.
THRJE.
Thurge, guessing. And they say, listen to this podcast for almost 2 years now, and I'd be lost without Jazza and Jimmy's almost weekly discussions on the truly surreal political events that have happened since. Although I describe myself as left-wing, the centrist yet honest and critical approach this podcast has is refreshing and has contributed to a lot of my own opinions on Brexit, Trump and Corbyn. Thanks, guys.
That's unfortunate probably, for that poor person.
It's probably the nicest review we've ever had. If you'd like to tweet us, then please do. If you'd like to be our patron, please do. If you'd like to leave us a review on iTunes, please do. Okay, we'll get on with the show now. Okay, right, fine. Okay, right. Yeah, I thought you wanted to say something.
I'm done, mate. I'm done. So, Jazza, do you use Uber?
Yeah, I do.
A lot, or...?
Probably less than you do, because you're a journalist who gets to wine and dine on the dollar of your rich clientele, right?
I don't really do that anymore. I've done that in previous jobs, but the dining opportunities are very sparse in the current role.
Oh.
It's very disappointing.
I'm sorry, man.
And usually they'd order you a cab rather than an Uber, because, you know, they don't care about money. That's why they're dining journalists.
Yeah, exactly. I do use it and have used it extensively in the past. I am aware of the moral problems with using Uber. For anybody who doesn't know, they've had a splattering of problems when it comes to how they report sexual assault of people who use their service.
Mm-hmm.
They don't claim responsibility for the people who use their app as drivers, because they're not technically employees
is the mm-hmm. thing. They see them as contractors.
Yeah, exactly.
And there have been some court cases in certain jurisdictions that have essentially said they're not really contractors, they're more like employees.
Mm-hmm.
But there's, depending on which country you're in, there's a whole load of controversy around that.
Yeah. They are... also, like, the business practices within Uber aren't particularly nice. And I have used Uber sparingly, but I have used it in the past.
Blood on your hands, then.
Yeah, blood on my hands.
I have.
Because you've never used
it. I've also used it, obviously.
Uh-huh.
I think everyone agrees that it's a good service, but just in terms of the convenience, and by comparison, and this is specific to London, but... black cabs are just like backwards, and it's all run by the unions, and they are famously resistant to like modern technology like credit cards. And you know, people complain that they won't drive outside of central London, and there's a whole load of other gum. So like, the black cabs are shit and Uber is much better, but Uber is also like not a very nice company, and you know, they're kind of exploiting their drivers to a certain extent, and there's the sexual harassment culture within the main company in Silicon Valley itself. And yeah, it's all very unpleasant, I guess.
So they had their license to function, to do business as a...
Yeah, so they're licensed as a private hire company, which is like essentially taxis that are not black cabs in London.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had it removed for like not being a fit and proper, to use the phrase, holder of said license. For all that, like for the reporting of crime, the background checks on their drivers as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a third thing, which I...
There was also Greyball.
That's what I'm thinking of, yeah. Mm-hmm. So explain what Greyball is.
So Greyball is a way of them being able to identify particular individuals or companies whom... like, they would say how they identify people who they don't want to use their services. So people who are criminals or use the app incorrectly or anything like that. But there's evidence that they've also used it in the past in order to avoid government officials being able to assess Uber's services. Mm-hmm. So basically what Grable does is it identifies these individuals, these like government officials or regulators, based on like SIM card data or based on location, and it will show them a version of Uber that is not what a regular customer would see.
Mm, that's pretty clever.
It is pretty clever, but also kind of shifty.
It's shifty. Apparently, I was reading a little bit about it, and apparently it wasn't quite illegal what they were doing. Like, it was still okay. Like, because they weren't obliged to provide the government with the information the government was looking for, or the regulators, I should say. That's what I read. Like, it wasn't like...
Sure, but if a regulator wants to check another private taxi service, they just need to call up or flag down a cab and have that experience.
I'm not saying it's not bad. I'm just saying it wasn't illegal.
It wasn't illegal because the law hadn't yet caught up with the technology.
Yeah, pretty much. And also, if someone accuses you of something shifty and your response is, well, it isn't illegal, mm-hmm. that's not a great defence, generally. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I mean, you can use that in certain contexts, but like, it's still pretty bad.
So they were able to, this is Uber, so their general manager from London, Tom Elvidge, said that 3.5 million Londoners who use our app and more than 40,000 licensed drivers who rely on Uber to make a living will be astounded by this decision. And they really are coming down on we are going to fight this, because they get to appeal this decision.
They're appealing, but apparently the appeals process isn't very long.
It could be until the end of the year, I believe.
Right. Yeah. Okay. But basically, during the appeals process, they get like a temporary license. Mm-hmm. So Uber will be running in London at least until the appeals process.
God, how am I going to get home?
And in theory, they'll like promise to clean up various problems with their service, and then TfL will be like, "Oh yeah, fine, you can do your thing then."
Do you think that that's going to happen? Because it looks like a lot of the problems that TfL decided were reasons to revoke this license for Uber. It seems like they're not stuff that can be fixed in a few weeks.
Yeah, well, some of it, I don't know, because if it was just like a bit of software tweaking, then you'd think, yeah, maybe. But like if some of it's like cultural, or like you need to actually develop processes to actually fix it. I guess if TfL thinks there are still problems, but they appear to be on the way to actually fixing them now, and we've shown them enough sticks so that, you know, they will actually get their house in order, they might be inclined to do so. But to be honest, I've no idea like how the appeals process works, mm-hmm. and like the background to that, so it's kind of hard to say.
The Standard, very quickly, the Evening Standard, which is like the free newspaper in London, which is owned by the former Chancellor, not owned, he's the editor.
It's edited by George Osborne.
It's really curious to see the Evening Standard become more and more his mouthpiece, because the Standard very quickly started supporting a lot of online campaigns, like hashtag boycott the black cabs, because it was the black cab unions that apparently put a lot of pressure on Transport for London in order to push this through. Do you think that this is an example of unions having too much power and being resistant to technological change?
Well, yeah, as I said earlier, like black cabs, they did need to be outcompeted. Mm-hmm. Like they were running an old-fashioned, shoddy service, and the thing that the black cab drivers always say is like, we have the knowledge, which is like the knowledge of London streets and stuff, and it's known as a sat nav these days. Anyone can fucking buy one. You know, that's not a thing anymore. Your service sucks, and you don't accept modern payments, and you need to sort your fucking shit out.
This is a direct message to the black cab drivers of London.
I doubt anyone listens to us, and you know, everyone's already made these arguments to them. I suppose they'd say in response, maybe we need to do that. However, we do have a union that protects our drivers' rights, and what does Uber have in response to that? But that said, all but one of like the Uber drivers I've actually talked to about their experience being an Uber driver have been really positive about it.
Yeah, and also, so there was, it's somewhat misleading when Uber come out and say that there are 30,000 to 40,000 drivers who depend on using the app as like a source of income. It's like, for most Uber drivers, it's going to be supplementary to other forms of income. Very few Uber drivers do it full time.
Yeah, I mean, an Uber driver that I I drove with a couple of months ago was
you
like
driving with him.
Driving with him. I was ridden by him, but that Jimmy sounds Nichols, like man that sounds of the bad. Sounds bad. there's no way out of this phrasing now. But he was like a bank staff member during most of the time, and he was like doing it so that he could save. He was doing Uber driving so he could save up money to study and do something else, basically. Mm. And that tends to be my experience chatting to them. But there's also like regular cabbies who use it as like a way of supplementing their income from doing other.
Yeah.
Cab work for, you know.
It's curious that we're talking about the resurgence of the black cab unions as well, because obviously the Uber drivers themselves, because they don't technically have a shared employer, it's very difficult for them to unionize, and Uber themselves have pushed back on attempts of their drivers unionizing and doing collective organization on behalf of all of the people that use the app in that way. It was interesting to see the response from the Independent Workers Union of Great Britain that really fell on the opposite side of the Black Cabs Union, saying that this was like a real blow for people who use the app as like a way of supplementing their income. Do you, as I think, believe that this is kind of like the old economy clashing with the new economy and ways that people make money?
Yeah, I see why people have interpreted it that way, but in a really narrow sense, it's just a regulatory decision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the licensing board of TfL looked at the guidelines as to who can hold a license, and they decided that Uber did not meet those guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
It's been portrayed as like what wider than that, and like, I guess you could argue that I don't even think you can really argue that it's a case of like regulations not catching up with technology, because it's not really about the gig economy. It's not about the use of the app. There was a previous dispute that Uber had with TfL, which was the black cab union said essentially an Uber app is a kind of there's a technical name for it, but like a taxometer or something mm-hmm. like that, which is like, essentially, when you get into a black cab, you see that little display that the money ticks up slowly as you drive further.
Yeah.
And that's like a regulated thing, which is, I mean, this is, it's an example of how crazy like taxi regulation is in London, that that's like a piece of technology you can only have, I think, if you're like a black cab driver, because mm-hmm, minicab mm-hmm. drivers just have to give you flat fares. So this is just a narrow regulatory decision, really. You can discuss like the wider implications of the gig economy or, you know, the Uber app in general, but really it's about the fact that Uber is not a well-run company. That's like the bottom line. This isn't saying that, you know, taxi hailing apps are bad and will never be allowed in London again. It's really mm-hmm. just about Uber.
Yeah, and it is important that a lot of the people who kind of lost their shit about the fact that they might not be able to use Uber in a couple of months, there are other taxi hailing services. Like
there are
Get Taxi and like Lyft, I think.
There's others like coming out. The trouble is that, I mean, Uber has profited massively from the network effect, in that it built a driver base and then a customer base mm-hmm. quite quickly, and then that became the best place to go to, because if you're looking to find a cab, you want the widest network of taxis mm-hmm. available. So I can, but you know, you can just get public transport. The night bus will not kill you. Probably.
I mean,
there's like maybe a 5%.
You took the night
5% chance at most that you'll get, you know, seriously injured on a night bus.
Mm-hmm. But I did find quite a lot of the response to it really frustrating, because it was as if like a load of people threw their toys out of the pram because they're going to have to download a different app. And everybody, I think, is aware that Uber is poorly run. Uber deliberately uses particular types of reporting when it comes to stuff like sexual assault in order to slow it down so that they never actually have to report it. So they report their...
Is that proven then?
It's alleged, not proven. Oh, like, I think, obviously, because otherwise they'd have lost their license a long time ago. But it's alleged that they go through transport for the TfL police.
Right.
Rather than the Metropolitan Police when it comes to sexual assault, because it takes longer and then they don't have to report it as an official crime.
Right, okay. I mean, the other aspect of this where I think people totally misinterpreted the decision was the attacks on Sadiq Khan. who has a lot of, like, he has friends with, he's friends with the unions, and that, you know, there's an argument that he caved to pressure from them, but he wasn't involved in this decision.
He's, do you not think that this could have been a political decision? Another protectionist decision by somebody who's at least pretended to be pro-Corbyn in the past?
I don't, well, I don't see any reason to believe that it was. I guess it's possible, you know, like, you know, I'm not saying British governments or British regulators are totally uncorrupt, but there's not, no one's produced any evidence to suggest that that is the case. And, well, as I said, this isn't really about, you know, him loving unions and hating taxi cab hailing firms. It's, you know, it's about Uber as a company, basically. Admittedly, he did support the decision after it was announced. So there is that aspect to it.
Yeah. Interestingly, quite a lot of that on Twitter has now been deleted.
You mean his tweets on...
Curious and curious. So, for the second time in about 3 years, the Catalans are going to have another pretend referendum.
Pretend referendum.
I do kind of feel really sorry for them, because clearly they really, really want one, and the government in Madrid keeps on saying no.
I feel like the government in Madrid is not handling this well. I think it's fair to say.
What is it? The shipping in of policemen in order to steal ballot papers and create political prisoners, or something else?
I mean, it's all, like, not great. Yeah, I would say, like, you know, when you have to send in police to a situation that's like to suppress democracy, that's not a good look, especially when you have a recent history of authoritarianism and dictatorship.
So, quite, yeah, like the amount of people who are like, Franco's back, it's a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
So the one of the reasons that this is controversial is because the Catalan Parliament currently has a majority of seats. Of individuals in Parliament that are in favour of independence, but it was a minority of votes that got those people into power.
Yeah, although it should be said that I think it's like 48% of Catalonians voted for pro-independence candidates, and then 36 or something voted for anti-independence candidates, but there's others who are like...
Who are like, eh?
I don't know, and they must be neutral on the question or something.
Yeah, like not sure. And so, in 2014, when Scotland had their independence referendum, the SNP very clearly had a majority in Parliament, and so there was...
Well, the Scottish Parliament. Yeah.
The Scottish Parliament, yeah. And so they were able to go to David Cameron and be like, yo, people kind of want this. Whereas well, the also, vote is also, a lot more splintered in Catalonia.
Yeah, but there is polling that suggests that a majority of Catalonians want a referendum, even if they don't want independence.
It gets... It's a very divided region, nation, at the moment. They've some people have done some polling, and apparently 75% of people who speak Catalan as their first language want independence, and 75% of people who have something other than Catalan as their first language, which includes Castilian Spanish, don't want independence. So this really is, I think, in a stronger way than the Scottish independence referendum. This is much more about kind of like identity and the history of Catalonia and the rest of Spain. Catalan, the language, for example, was suppressed under the Franco regime. The Catalans pay a lot more in general into the Spanish budget than they get out of it.
When you say it's more about identity than the Scottish thing, do you not think the Scottish thing was... mostly about identity? What do you see the Scottish thing being?
I feel like the cultural differences between Catalonia and the rest of Spain are more stark than they are between Scotland and the rest of Britain. That's what I mean by it.
Right.
In terms of, like, obviously, an independence referendum, for there to be a case for independence, I think there has to be some momentum behind it that is cultural in some
way. Well, there was the Scottish thing, I guess you could say, was political in as much as it was kind of seen as an anti-Thatcher vote to a certain degree, or an anti-conservative vote. And the SNP definitely played up the idea that if you don't vote for independence, we're going to be ruled by Tories for the rest of time, which, as the previous general election shows, was maybe not like the wisest prediction to make.
I mean, very different political times.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah. What do you see as the outcome to all of this, then? Well, I mean, surely Madrid has to cave at some point.
Okay, so this is the thing. Because Madrid have said that this referendum, the second one that they've had in 3 years, is illegal, and they've sent in all of the Guardia Civil to take away all of the ballot papers, they are making it incredibly difficult for this referendum to actually go ahead in any kind of constitutional or democratic way whatsoever.
Mm.
You saw a load of pro-independence people handing out ballot papers on the streets and telling people to give these to all of their friends. And so there is no way, shape or form that there is any possibility of this referendum happening, or this ballot, or whatever you want to call it, happening on the 1st of October. There's no way, shape or form that it's actually to be legally binding or taken seriously in any
way. It could physically happen, but the result can't be interpreted as valid.
No, in no way. What I really worry about is that the huge crackdown that the central government have chosen to enforce on Catalonia is going to, like, I feel like there's only so many times that you can try and kick a can down a road. Like, this is going to ingrain those differences between those who want independence and those who do not.
Well, presumably those people that weren't in favour of independence or were, like, fairly wishy-washy on it, that now think, having seen how the Madrid government treats us, I would vote for independence.
I feel like more people are like, we just need to have this vote.
Yeah.
What I anecdotally have found is that those who support independence are now even more pro-independence, and those who didn't want independence originally are now even more staunchly like, I don't want to have independence.
Mm, that's interesting.
Well, it's what people kind of get entrenched and dig their ditches and stay where they are politically when they're challenged. What a surprise.
What a surprise, yeah.
It is kind of worrying, for me at least, that the police are... I know that there are legally a load of challenges that Madrid has had for this independence vote in Catalonia, and they're saying that they're simply stopping an illegal act. But it looks very bad when a formerly authoritarian government... it was only like 40 years ago that Spain was under a Franco dictatorship, chooses to physically take away the ability of a people who have traditionally been repressed by the central government, their ability to partake in democracy. And
in a legal sense, Madrid's probably correct in that for a region of a country to secede, you generally do need the central government in that country to agree to a secession or agree to a referendum on the question, at least.
But I think that anybody would argue that Catalonia probably needs to have this decision at some point, because it's just ramped up intensity.
I totally agree with that. And I don't really understand why the Madrid government doesn't see that a referendum at this point is, if not inevitable, sort of needs to happen for the...
needs to be like a release valve.
Yeah, exactly.
Of some kind.
Yeah. So why do you think that they don't see things that way?
It's fear of losing the richest part of the country, I think, is a huge thing. Also losing the culture wars. There's a huge difference between how Spanish-identifying people see themselves and see the united country, and Catalan people who see themselves as Catalan first and Spanish second, or even not Spanish at all. But then I also wanted to talk about the fact that when we had the Scottish referendum, do you remember the white book that Alex Salmond...
Yeah, the white paper.
Which was basically, this is how we're going to be an independent country.
Yeah, I mean, it was like cloud cuckoo land sort of stuff.
Well, it wasn't perfect, but it at least had a vaguely clear idea of what it was going to look
like. The only thing I remember is like oil revenues.
At the time it worked.
I think oil revenues collapsed like shortly like after the vote took place.
But they had like a, this is what the country is going to look like, this is how we're going to fund things, this is what's going to happen, we are going to apply to be part of the European Union, blah, 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 blah. Because the independence vote in Catalonia is fractured amongst many parties, there are so many more different ideas of what an independent Catalonia is going to look like. And so it's very... if you are voting for independence here, you are taking more of a leap into the dark than Scotland ever like was going to do, because you're there's no clear idea of what the monetary situation is going to be like, even less so than in Scotland, because Catalonia and the rest of Spain use the euro. There's it's not clear whether people are going to remain European citizens, and if Catalonia is going to reapply. It's not even been entertained by the central government in the European Union in Brussels. It's such a shit show, and I kind of really wish that the Catalan regional government would get its shit together and actually get a proposal together so that it can be taken seriously by the electorate and by Madrid. Madrid aren't making this easy.
At least Catalonia has a regional government that's in power that is pushing for the referendum, whereas the obvious comparison is the Brexit referendum, where David Cameron, where the government was campaigning against the referendum that it was holding, which is just a really, as we found out increasingly, a very difficult situation when you lose the vote because you, you know, didn't make any preparations at all for the fact that that was a possibility.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a shit show.
I do think, in relation to the EU thing, that it does, and I, you know, I think the Brexit vote and the fallout from that has shown that up as well, that there are severe dangers in governments agreeing to sort of international treaties and stuff like the EU, which at its core is basically a large international treaty, over the heads of the people that they represent, and then creating another layer of governance which is very separated and very remote and very difficult to keep account of. It's bad when you do that, because you get things like this where people want more local self-determination, essentially, and then when it comes to like, okay, how would Catalonia actually leave Spain and remain part of the EU? Is that even possible? And then it blows up all of these difficult things.
And what is also very difficult, there's a lot of conversations happening now in Spain that I remember happening in Scotland, where it's like, well, would this possibly create a domino effect of independence movements across the rest of the European Union? Because if Scotland were to have become independent, if Catalonia were to become independent, then that kind of sets a precedent for any other independence movement across the rest of the EU, of which there are, like, many.
I mean, some of them are, like, Cornish, though. Like,
no, but there are some, like, legitimate ones, like the Basque Country, the Basque region, like Corsica, I think Belgium wants to be three countries.
Belgium's not a real country. Not hating, but...
Sorry, Belgian listeners. I'm sure we have at least one.
Probably, yeah. The thing is, though, it is true that that is happening on a shorter scale, but in the long... Like, if you look at the post-Second World War, the number of smaller independent countries has increased massively, just because the principle of, oh, you can't just go invading and conquering countries anymore was, like, somewhat taken off the table.
Yeah. So I mean, for I feel legitimate reasons.
Oh, yeah. I'm not complaining. You know, although, you know, there's cases where you need to sort out the border gore, you know. It just doesn't look good on a map. But, yeah, generally speaking, that's been a thing. So it's not really that weird that it's happening within the context of the EU, I don't think. I think you can read too much into that.
I think so. But perhaps because of the hugely complex identities that are in very concentrated geographical areas across the EU, we are going to have more desires for more regional government and more regional kind of, not necessarily independence, but people having local representatives much more so than the national and the pan-national level that we have in the European Union.
Yeah, possibly. One kind of last question. Is the kind of character of Catalonian independence, I mean, you seem to indicate it was quite varied, but is it more of like the civic nationalism that is represented by the SNP, or is it more of like a sort of slightly, is it a nasty nationalism that would be represented by a party like UKIP or AfD in Germany? Like a more bigoted sort of inward-looking nationalism, rather than just this idea of, you know, people can come into our country.
So Catalonians tend to be a lot more pro immigration, more multicultural than a lot of other parts of Spain, and they, in a similar way to Scotland, kind of define themselves apart from other parts of Spain that probably had different roles to play under the Franco regime in that way. However, that's not to say that Catalonians fighting for independence do not have a nasty side. In the same way that, like, Plaid Cymru in Wales, there are lots of examples in, like, North Wales of English people living in Wales having bricks through their windows just because they're English. That definitely happens in Catalonia. However, I will say, I think that it's a lot easier for people to be accepted as Catalonian than it is to, say, be accepted as... I'm not sure what another example would be. But if I, like, if I go there and I speak Catalan and I learn to speak Catalan, I'll probably be accepted as a Catalonian
a
lot quicker than I would if I were to go up to Scotland and still speak with an English accent.
Interesting.
Mm. So now, you're going to go on a journey with me, listener. And we're going to... I'm taking you on a trip, and I'm going to chat to Felix Simon, who writes for the Telegraph on occasion, about the German election. Is there anything you want to know, Jimmy?
Many things. In relation to that? Or
yeah,
just,
in relation to that.
Oh, let me think. I'll chat to you, like, in the backgrounds, and then, you know, you can ask him.
Cool, excellent. Thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me. Can you explain to the listeners what it is you do? Vaguely.
Vaguely?
Yeah.
I could say I'm fun employed, but that would be a bit stark. So,
that implies joy.
Yes. No, I'm currently working as a freelance journalist for several newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them... German newspapers, so like the FAZ and Die Welt.
Mm-hmm.
But I also write, for instance, for The Telegraph and the British European Journalism Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's how I spend my time writing and researching.
You actually helped big time when I was researching for the video that I made on my channel.
Thank you.
If you haven't watched it, please do, because it's kind of been taken over by right-wing trolls at the moment. I'd like to hear some love. Please. But basically, what's happened in Germany is that there was an election a few days ago.
Yes.
Angela Merkel is still the Chancellor of Germany.
Surprisingly.
What is that surprising?
Yes, I think 2 years ago, so during the height of the refugee crisis, no one would have expected Merkel to, first thing, stand in another election, and second thing, survive one. So,
and win it. She got
30-something percent
of the vote, right?
So yes, two years ago, no one would have thought that she can actually do this and pull this off, and it has worked, as we see.
So she's become the largest party. Her Christian Democrats have become the largest party. She is probably going to end up forming a coalition with the Greens and the Free Democrats.
Free Democratic Party, yes.
So that means that there's no longer going to be a grand coalition. The last 4 years have been a grand coalition with the second largest party, where they've had 80% of seats in parliament, which is crazy, also kind of normal.
I'm not sure whether it was actually 80% of seats in parliament, to be honest.
79%.
Really?
I did the maths. Yeah.
Christ. I thought it was less.
No. There's been, like, no opposition for the past 4 years. But that's kind of what I wanted to ask. When she goes into this kind of three-way coalition, she's only going to have 52% of seats in the Bundestag.
Yes.
How is that going to affect her kind of identity as, for want of a better word, strong and stable? Maybe I should put a trigger warning at the beginning.
No,
that's
fine.
Strong and stable.
I personally think it will have a great impact on her ability to get things done, because Jamaica coalition, as we call it, because the colours are, CDU is black, FDP is yellow, and
nothing
the Greens are of course
Jamaica.
Green.
Yeah.
Yes, it's got nothing to do with Jamaica, but that's just the way we call it. So Jamaica coalition will definitely be less stable than anything she ever had to deal with before. So all the previous coalitions, I think the first one was actually just with the FDP,
mm-hmm.
and then two grand coalitions with the SPD.
Mm-hmm.
She could reign supreme in those, and she was...
Reign supreme.
Yeah, she was... she was the queen. And showing them the direction, and this time it would be much more difficult with both the FDP and the Greens, and its Jamaica coalition, because they're not... what you would call natural allies. So the CDU is still kind of center conservative ish.
Like equivalent to British conservatives.
Yes, I think a bit less conservative perhaps, but basically comparable. FDP is probably something like the Lib Dems in the UK.
Yeah.
And of course the Greens, and they, it's not what you would think of as the natural group of friends. So it would be quite difficult for Merkel to strike a balance with all these different quite opposing elements, because all of these parties also have a more kind of left wing and more right wing. So probably with the exception of the FDP, which is pretty much the centre. But for instance,
they're like free market, liberal,
pro business.
Yeah, exactly.
But for instance, CDU is heavily torn between the more fundamentalist part of the party or wing of the party, which was actually the group which found the party in the late 70s, and the more conservative, liberal, centrist wing of the party, which is currently at the head of the party, leading the party.
So Merkel has an image across Europe and across the world as being like this great leader, or like the most successful leader in the Western world, probably, to be completely honest. Having governed for 12 years, she's been chancellor. With this greatly reduced majority and more kind of like intricate balancing act that she's going to have to do with two other parties, is it there a possibility of her power and identity as this great successful leader, is it possible that that's going to decline in the next 4 years?
I think it certainly depends on the issue. So within Germany, and as concerns domestic politics, this would definitely have an effect, because she's got 33%, which is quite a lot, but she definitely has to make concessions to the FDP and the Greens.
And so that's dropping from the CDU had 40% in the last election.
So quite a significant drop in what they've got. And this would clearly affect her ability to just push through certain bills. And especially because both the leaders of the FDP and the Greens won't shy away from confrontation, because they know that
They have a lot of power.
Yes, they have a lot of power. Merkel can't form a government without them at the moment. And they've already outlined pretty clear issues which are non-negotiable for them. So for instance, the Greens say, okay, without progression as regards environmental politics or strengthening of the Eurozone, we won't deal with you. And Merkel has to factor that in. But I think as regards her reputation internationally and her approach towards the States and the Euro and Russia, I don't think we'll see much change. So one thing that has been brought up, especially in the UK, was that people expected Merkel's position on Brexit to change. But make no mistake, this is not going to happen. So
yeah, it's kind of been a bit embarrassing watching the German election unfold and Brexit just not being something that any German people care about. Surprise, surprise.
Yes, I think that's mainly because it's probably one of the few issues all the parties agree on.
Literally, we need to get fucked.
No, not that you need to get fucked, but rather that that Britain has decided to leave, and we respect that. Yeah. Although we,
it's very kind of you, Felix.
You're welcome. It's not something that we like, and it's something that we definitely didn't want to happen. But that's the state of things at the moment, and we have to make this a good deal for everyone. But it has also been Merkel's position and the position of all the other party leaders, with exception of the AfD, that the Eurozone comes first. So, of course, the integrity of the Eurozone, the integrity of the Euro, the stability of the Eurozone is our natural interest at the moment. And we won't see, even in a more or less shaky Jamaica coalition, we won't see, at least I think we won't see much change in this position, because all the leaders, so Merkel, Christian Lindner of the Free Democrats, and Cem Özdemir, and what was the other one? Shouldn't know her name. Damn it.
It's okay.
They all agree that this is important. And also they're pretty much on the same page as regards Germany's position towards the States or towards Russia.
You mentioned the AfD just then. They are the first kind of like far right party to get seats in the Bundestag.
Since the 60s, yes.
Oh, yeah. Since we can remember.
Yes. So we had the, of course, the Nazis during the Third Reich, but there was...
Oh, really? What? I don't know about that.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
And afterwards, there was a party called, I think it was called Deutsche Partei, so German mm-hmm. party, and they were more or less comparable to the AfD in certain kind of certain policies.
Yeah. So the big upset of this is that the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland.
Lovely.
Thank you. Yeah, good. they came third in this election, which is more than some people expected them to get.
Yes.
But they ended up with about 13% of the vote, are going to get about 80 to 90 seats-ish.
I think it's 89 at the moment.
Okay.
And some people laugh about that because it's not 88.
Well, that's terrible. But they are going to have a significant number of
yes.
people in the Bundestag, which is made up of around between 580 and 630-ish.
It varies.
People. Yeah, it varies because you have a sensible system, actually. but it is quite complicated. For people who don't know a lot about the AfD, the word, and you used it as well, the word Nazi gets thrown around an awful lot because it's Germany and the far right. Hey.
Yes.
How much is that actually true? And how much of it is sensationalism and just us throwing around that N-word? Not that N-word, the other N-word.
I think it's definitely a really good question because, as you say, people are using the word Nazi quite lavishly and just mm-hmm. throw it out. Personally, I would say it's a bit sensationalist, but probably accurate for some members of the mm-hmm. AfD. Because, I mean, to understand this, we probably have to look first at what is a Nazi. So generally, adherents of National Socialism, specific set of practices associated with the Nazi ideology, like fascism, and mm-hmm. then you've got racism, anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. nationalism, and so forth. And for some members of the AfD, you could definitely say that they are associated with at least
few. They share those ideologies.
They share those, at least some of these ideologies, mm-hmm. if not all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely true. There are some AfD party members who you could easily call Nazis or neo-Nazis. So
mm-hmm.
one really famous guy, and I have to be careful not to mistake his name, because his name is actually Björn Höcke, but people make fun of him and call him Bernd, which he hates.
No, you can call him whatever you want on the right dishonorable.
Probably just call him Bernd Höcke because I don't like him. No. I think he's by now been thrown out of the AfD because it was really... he was the guy with the Holocaust statements.
Fun.
Yes, exactly. and he is definitely someone I would personally call a Nazi
mm-hmm.
because he conforms to all these beliefs. He's literally someone who is anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. Racist, all that other stuff, nationalist.
But a lot of that kind of ends up getting focused on, surprise, surprise, a lot of the far right focus on the threat of Islam. How much does that play into in the fear, like post-refugee crisis and Germany taking in so many refugees? How much of that positioning of the AfD as defenders of white Germany against the influx of people from the Middle East and North Africa, how much of that is their identity?
I think it's probably one of the core parts of the AfD ideology.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue that anti-Semitism has been supplanted by anti-Islamist
mm-hmm.
tendencies.
Mm-hmm.
So their stance against refugees, against Islam in general, and against Muslims is basically the anti-Semitism of the AfD,
mm-hmm.
which is not to say that there are no anti-Semites in the AfD, because these yeah. people are there as well.
Somebody needs to tell them that they're all Abrahamic religions.
Like, yes.
But they all technically
yes.
believe in the same God.
Yes.
Goodness sake. How much power are they going to have as the third largest party?
Quite a lot. So it's not as much as some people tend to believe,
mm-hmm.
but sitting in the Bundestag comes with certain privileges, so they will sit on quite a lot of important committees,
mm-hmm.
Where they will have the right to speak, the right to make decisions, the right to question the government and yes, this is a cool part of democracy and it should be that way, but with the AfD, it's, well, it's a bit scary. And given that the SPD has now decided to move into the opposition, this will at least prevent the AfD from just
being the official opposition.
Being the official
which would
opposition.
Have been the problem if Merkel had decided to go into a grand coalition against the SPD.
I think their main power as such a strong party in the Bundestag, and we should note that 30% is quite a significant result. Because usually, usually all the smaller parties in Germany pop bottles when they can reach, say, 8 or 10% after a general election. That's considered a really good result. And 30% is, from a standing position, it's just stellar.
Yeah.
So their main power will actually be to play, or to be a really potent thorn in Merkel's side. And they can, as has done, as we've seen with UKIP and the Front National in France, they will be able to steer the discourse and shift conversations we as Germans have as a society.
Yeah, that went really well for us.
Yes, unfortunately.
I'd love to... So, people, you were saying a couple of years ago that people said that Merkel would never run for Chancellor again in this election because of the fact that she probably shot herself in the foot with the accepting of so many refugees.
True.
She... Like, people are now saying that she's not going to run in 2021, which is the next general election. I mean, who knows? Things might change again.
I've heard voices who actually said, well, it could well be that Merkel considers running again. I think it's unlikely, but who knows? Mm-hmm. She's always in for a surprise.
How likely do you think it is that she'll stay for the full 4 years? And who is going to be there to kind of stand in that power vacuum once she leaves? Or is there anyone yet?
What a question. I mean, if I only had the answer. I think...
That's why you are here.
Yes. No, personally, I would think that she will do the full 4 years, because Merkel is not... She's not someone who would do 2 or 3 years... would do 2 years and then suddenly resign and say, okay, this is it. I think... I personally expect her to do the full term in office and then gracefully leave. But then there is the problem of who's going to be his successor. This is quite a tricky question, because to understand that, we have to delve a bit into Merkel's personal history within the CDU, because she's known as the Black Widow for a reason. Yes, because...
Go on, why is she... I didn't know that she was known as the Black Widow. Is it because she's a superhero at night?
Maybe, we don't know. No, she's been very skilled in outmaneuvering all the alpha males in her own party who sought to bring about her downfall several times over the course of the last 12 years. So by now, everyone within the CDU knows, don't mess with Merkel, if I may say so. This is literally all the male protagonists in the CDU are quite afraid of challenging Merkel, because they know it can end badly for them.
Is that different to her having allies and like successors? Because if you look at Theresa May, like, she's very weak at the moment, but had she won a huge majority, it's very clear who kind of like her successors were. She's a big fan of Amber Rudd and of a lot of the women in her cabinet. There were clear people that would have probably started to be groomed to be the person who were her allies. Yes. Does Merkel have a similar kind of thing?
She does have allies, and she has people in the party whom she definitely trusts. But these are usually the people who are very loyal and probably not those guys or people who would openly challenge her. So, for instance, the secretary for the Kanzleramt, which is not sure what the comparison would be in the UK, but he's basically her head of office, Peter Altmaier. He's quite an influential figure, very skilled politician, quite well liked, but he's no one who would be chancellor material for various reasons, which are too complicated to go into detail at the moment.
Is that not kind of what people said about Merkel, though?
Yes, maybe.
Because she is, especially in the mid-2000s when she first came to power, she was an unconventional, boring, uncharismatic, quote-unquote, leader.
It could perfectly be, but
Felix, thank you so much for coming and chatting. This was fun, wasn't it?
Yes, it was
where
definitely
can,
nice.
People find your work and you and abuse you or throw adulation your way?
It's probably best to just find me on Twitter, which is @_FelixSimon_. Mm-hmm. So that's usually where I...
Who has Felix Simon? Some bastard.
I don't know. I really would like to find this person.
I'll try and find them and I'll see what I can do.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Toodaloo. Oh, wait. Okay, now it's gone.